table. For my money, he was too flashy and showing off. But our crew was proud of him. And standing right over him as if I owned him, I guess I was too. Although never completely losing the feeling that something was missing in him somewhere. By what he had said earlier, he was playing percentage poker. Although I wouldn't have called it that. It was a lot more daring than just sitting there counting the spots and playing the odds. For instance, twice in a short time, he had a chance to open the betting on a pair of jacks. Jacks were the lowest openers. And twice he passed, and twice somebody else opened, and then both times he raised the opening bet. But from there on, he played each hand differently. To the first hand, he drew only one card, as if to suggest he was holding two pairs and hadn't opened the betting on them because of the difficulties you can get into with two pairs if you have to bet on them before getting an idea of what anybody else has. The smallest of the faceless three, who was sitting to the cook's left, opened the betting, and he drew an honest three, which meant, since jacks were openers, that he could be holding any one of three pairs that would beat the cook. And at worst, he couldn't be holding less than a pair of jacks, which was all the cook was holding after he drew his one card. Bigger Brim and Biggest Brim dropped out after the raise. Since Big Brim had opened, it was his turn to bet first after the draw. And thinking a long time about the raise the cook had given him, he passed. The cook had done his thinking long before. He bet $2. $2 at that stage of the game was a pretty good-sized bet. Not staggering, as if you were betting big because you weren't holding much, but big enough to look as if you had what you thought could win, and you wanted to get the other guys to stay in the betting. This time Big Brim had done all his thinking. He showed a pair of queens for openers, and the cook lowered his elbows and embraced the pile of money. Biggest Brim grunted. If I'd been playing against him, I would have figured he didn't like to be bluffed. The second time that the cook didn't open the pot on a pair of jacks, but instead raised, he drew not one but two cards, as if to suggest he had three of a kind. And damned if one of the two cards he drew wasn't another jack. So he ended with three of a kind. Of course, when you're that lucky, you don't have to be Nick the Greek to play them. This time, Big Brim and Biggest Brim both stayed in the game, and it cost Biggest Brim nearly $5 to think he discovered that the cook didn't bluff because he ended up with three jacks. As the cook's winnings increased, he became cockier, and he began to talk, and his game got even better. He was the only one who talked, and he talked all the time about his cards. One of the best poker players I ever saw was a punch-drunk prize fighter who, like the cook, talked all the time about what he was holding. You couldn't tell what to believe about anything he said, but you couldn't stop listening. The cook would say, "I'm going to raise you on a pair of jacks," and he'd have three kings. And then later he'd say, "I'm going to try to raise you again on a pair of jacks." And this time that's just what he had. Always he talked about his hand, and generally he lied, but every now and then what he said was what he held, and only I, who was behind him, could tell the difference. I was glad I wasn't playing against him. Obviously, it was also the flashiest poker the three Brims from Hamilton had seen in some time. Biggest Brim twisted around in his chair until he could pull out his purse from a hip pocket. It was a little black purse that snapped shut, and he unsnapped it and unfolded several bills. Then he untwisted, traded bills for silver dollars, started a new pile with the dollars, and went on losing. Although only the cook talked, there was an audible relaxation of muscles between deals, except for Bill, who never moved unless to keep Biggest Brim in front of him. Otherwise, Bill was a giant hat and a pair of shoulders in shadows, and in light, a pair of hands resting on hips that by now everyone besides me had studied. Mr. Smith was a full-time giant beside the door, occasionally looking back in the direction of the 38 Smith & Wesson. My left arm was slightly brushed, and looking down on me but pretending to look at the card game was Mr. McBride. He was standing so much over me that if it had been raining, he would have dripped off the corners of his mustache onto my head. I was glad to have that feeling over me. and I reached inside my shirt and touched the sugar sack. Still, I didn't like it that nearly all our crew were standing in the rim of light around the table, except Mr. Smith and the two lookouts, whose names and locations I can't remember. I wasn't much worried about the three faceless wonders at the table. After all, we had them outnumbered, and if they were fighty, they'd been sitting soft all summer around a green table, while we'd been getting case-hardened climbing the high hills. I was worried about the extra help that might come out of nowhere. I'd seen at least two housemen working the pool room earlier in the evening. Then some of those clumsy pool players had to be housemen who were only faking, and would take you to the cleaners if you dropped in from another town and thought you were good. There was also that 38 behind the bar. Still another question. How many of the customers would stick with the house in a fight? There's no way of answering that now. It could depend on who was winning, or how the Oxford treated its customers, or on how many friends Bill had in the house. At present, they were standing back in the shadows, but probably were all for war up in front. As for me personally, I knew I'd take a beating. It was getting so that every few minutes I'd feel the sugar sack. Evidently, the bartender hadn't yet dared come as far as the door to look. The cook kept on winning, not big, but steadily. And I began to think he would go on playing his so-called percentage game for the rest of the night, as it would have been percentage to do. But I kept forgetting that one thing you can be sure about a show-off is that he will show off. When it happened, there was a good-sized pot, not big enough to risk your shirt on, and certainly not big enough to risk getting shot over, but still a fair-sized pot. Three or four deals in a row had been passed without an opening bet, and of course, each time everybody had to ante, so the pot got to be a pretty good one. Actually, the cook had made the last deal, and when nobody had an opening bet, I knew he was still dealing honest. Everybody chipped into the pot again, and the cook passed the cards to Big Brim, who was sitting to his left. Big Brim handled cards better than anyone in the game except the cook, and was even slightly ahead, but by now I was sure that none of the Brims was a great card player. I asked myself, anyway, what the hell ever made you think a great card player would be staying in Hamilton? Now I had them cased as pretty good card players, who probably had a few two-bit tricks up their sleeves to fool the ranch hands and us Forest Service stiffs from the high brush. Big Brim dealt out the hands, and the cook picked his up, and had just started to sort it when he put his cards face down on the table, leaned over, and slightly raised Big Brim's hat. "I beg your pardon," he said with a little stately speech. "I always like to see a man's face when I play cards with him." I saw something flash and disappear as the cook withdrew his hand from the hat, like the tail of a rabbit into the brush. But even though I stretched my neck, I couldn't get sight of it again. I knew, though, that something had happened to Big Brim from the sudden stir among people across the table who could get a front view of him. Biggest Brim closed his cards in one fist and half pushed himself up from the table. Bill stepped from behind him for a better view and perhaps a better shot. Bigger Brim, who had done little more in the game than lose, raked in his little pile of money, whereupon I reached in my shirt and got a fist on the sugar sack. Big Brim himself, though, didn't seem to notice that a rabbit had ducked into his hat or something like that. With his hat now tilted away from me, he leaned back and started to sort his cards. He had his move timed perfectly. Just when the cook had finished sorting his hand and had definitely assumed possession of it. "Sorry, partner," he said to the cook, "but you'll have to throw in your hand. You've an extra card."
"Who, me?" asked the cook.
"Yes, you," said Big Brim. "You have six cards in your hand. You must have had that extra card up your sleeve just for a big pot like this one."
"Count 'em," said the cook,
and he spread them face down in a small fan in front of Big Brim. Big Brim spread them even further apart and counted.
"How many?" asked the cook.
Big Brim went back over the cards, spread them even further apart,
felt each one and gave them another count. From across the table, Bill asked, "How many?" Big Brim looked at the cook and not at Bill. "Five," he said, still feeling the cards. The cook said, blown wide open with pride, "If you're looking for that extra card you dealt me to get my hand thrown out of the game, you'll find it in your hat band." Big Brim took off his hat and rested it on the table while he tried to believe it. There in his hat band was the deuce of clubs, the lowest card in the deck. But if it had still been in the cook's hand, it would have put him out of the game. The aces the cook had palmed into my shirt pocket at Elk Summit jumped out of my mind like rabbits and arranged themselves around the band of Big Brim's hat. Nobody needed to tell me how the deuce of clubs got there or where the rabbit had gone. I went for the money. First for the pot on the table, figuring that the cook should be able to protect his pile till I got there. I don't know who started the fight. I heard a chair crash. Either somebody got hit with a chair or was knocked off one. Somebody slugged me as I reached for the pot, and it happened just as I had imagined it would. Somebody from the side slugged me high on the jaw, and I never saw him. I guess it was Big Brim, and it must have been Mr. McBride who flattened him. Anyway, while I was still reaching for the pot, Big Brim lit on top of me and didn't move until I heaved up straight and let him slide off. There was still some money left in the pot that hadn't spilled or been taken, but when I reached over to pick up the remains, somebody grabbed my arm and somebody else stretched out and helped him twist it. I could also feel things hurt in my ear where I was hit on the side of my head. When I finally got my arm loose, it was so weak I couldn't pick up the rest of the pot. But I didn't miss much, maybe a couple of dollars of change that were hard to pick up with numb fingers. Instead, I went for the pile of money in front of the cook, who, so help me, was just sitting there. You would think that somebody would have flattened him right off, but there he sat with a tuft on his head, and nobody had laid a hand on him. Probably because, as I said earlier, among men, the card shark is a sorcerer in everyone's eyes, and this one had just performed magic. Maybe they were afraid they'd go up in smoke if they touched him. So there he sat, untouched, and maybe untouchable. The son of a bitch didn't even help me stuff his money into the sack, although I think I got it all. Then somebody hit me between the eyes harder than I was ever able to remember. I just stood there, and my clothes felt like a potato sack, and my body felt like potatoes, and the sack sank to the floor with me inside it. I tried to remain conscious. I tried to think, knowing I was nodding at the fringe of reality. I tried to think big thoughts, as if I were having thoughts about life. I even started sentences that began, "Life is..." But I never finished them because I never had any thoughts to put in them. At first, everything corresponded exactly with my foresight. I reached across the table for the money, and there was no way I could protect myself. Next, as in anticipation, I felt actual blood from inside my head slip down my throat. But as I folded on the floor, everything became unexpected. Suddenly, as if from nowhere, I got not one but two ideas of how I could have protected myself when I reached across the table. Whereas for weeks before, when an idea would have done some good, I couldn't get a single one. I struggled to my elbows to see if it was too late to act, but once on the tripod of my elbows, I could tell the ideas weren't worth a damn. And in another moment, they disappeared, never to be remembered again. While my body was still raised off the floor, though, I managed to shove the sugar sack into my shirt. In the process, I realized I recognized some of the feet under and around the table. Lying again on the floor on the side of my face, I wondered, since I couldn't think believable thoughts, whether by watching feet I could figure out some of what was going on. I lifted my face again from the sawdust and stained Bull Durham butts and again put it on the tripod of elbows.
This was to be the biggest fight I ever viewed almost entirely from the prone position, and under a poker table. Right off the bat, I could tell us guys from those guys. They were the cowboy boots, and we were the logging boots. And I remembered with a sickly feeling that later this night we were going to clean out all the ranch hands in town. It took me time to sort out this fight between men up to their knees. But things got clearer. And first, there was the biggest pair of cowboy boots right across from me. The knees were spread wide apart and the boots were turned up at the toes. Bill, the redhead, and the Canadian must have nailed him to his chair before he ever moved. And suddenly a pair of cowboy boots went straight up in the air and then just dangled there. One of our boys must have draped this body across the poker table and left his head and feet hanging over. To check, I looked on the opposite side, and sure enough, there was his head with saliva stringing out of his mouth. I looked back real quick to see who of our guys had stretched out the body, and just as expected, there were Bill's big loggers spread out. Bill's loggers, you remember, had that fringed extra tongue. You couldn't miss them. And they were working slowly towards me. Suddenly, a pair of city shoes jumped into the front ring, belonging, I guess, to one of the housemen who racked up the pool balls. His legs danced once and disappeared rhythmically into the blue. I don't know what happened to him, but he left so suddenly that Bill must have taken him, too. A faded pair of Levi's went bow-legged and kept on spreading until Mr. McBride sank down beside me. I didn't have strength to move out of his way, so he just leaned against me. The pair of loggers that skipped in and out across the table had to belong to his red-headed son. He could make those loggers move, and I could see that it helped him and our guys to be wearing loggers and not cowboy boots. Everybody in town yelled at us stiffs from the Forest Service when we walked indoors. Because, admittedly, the sharp caulks in the soles of our loggers left little holes in the floors. But when that fast red-headed kid jumped back to duck and counterpunch, those loggers held on the wood floor, and the slick, high-heeled cowboy boots trying to sidestep his counterpunches slipped and then skidded. It's hard to believe, but the Canadian putties were standing most of the time, only once in a while bending at the knee and coughing. All the time, sitting flat-footed next to me, was a pair of low canvas shoes with rubber soles like a pair of girls' basketball shoes. They just sat there flat-footed. I started to climb to my feet even before I determined to. It took me a couple of pushes and I wobbled on the way up. It was funny, but right then I thought of my Presbyterian father, and I quit wobbling. The cook picked up the cards and strained them through his hands, just keeping his hands soft, I suppose. I hit him on the side of the head, about where I thought I'd been hit. He bounced to the floor, and I went down softly. I knew that I hadn't hit him hard. I didn't have the strength. Mr. McBride must have been coming, too, because he rolled over slightly to make room for me. I was fairly sure that the cook, who was curled up, was playing possum. I saw one of his eyes open and study me. Then, when he became sure that I was pretty much beyond recall, he jumped up and started kicking me. Among lumberjacks, this is known as giving the guy the leather. And you not only put the boots to him when he's down, but you also rake him with the sharp caulks bristling from your soles. And what you leave behind is full of dirt and takes a long time to heal. Only I wasn't being kicked by loggers, but by girls' basketball shoes. Even so, the bastard managed to kick me once on the side of the head, just about where I'd been hit, and I could feel blood start down my throat again. I tried to catch one of his feet and trip him, and I caught one, but I couldn't hold it. And suddenly, both canvas shoes went straight up in the air, and I heard something crash. And later, I was to have it confirmed that the cook hit the wall and that Bill threw him there. Anyway, spread in front of me was a pair of loggers with a fringed double tongue. Then Bill reached over and picked me up with one arm, and before he'd fully straightened, he reached down again and picked up Mr. McBride with his other arm. He shook both arms and said, "How are you?" And we both said, as if we'd talked it over together,
Oh, we're all right. We both started sliding out of his arms. And he took a fast new hold on us and said, Now wait a minute. Then, with his arms around us, he made us walk a few steps. And just a few steps helped to clear things up. And both of us, feeling embarrassed by being held, muttered, Thanks, Bill, and tried to push free. And he grinned to see us better, but he still held us tight. This time he walked us 5 or 6 steps and back again, and this time we pushed free from him and regained our manhood and tried to appear as if we were looking for more fight. But the fight was nearly over. Off to one side, the redhead was fighting with some town guy in a buttoned shirt. Mr. McBride wobbled over and broke it up just as his son absorbed a roundhouse punch to his belly. But the old man wouldn't let him go on, and the town guy was glad to quit on the strength of getting in the last punch. His son walked off with bowed head, thinking deep thoughts. And then he whirled and ran after the town guy to start the fight over again, but now the crowd came out of the shadows and held him back. The crowd that was all for war when I disappeared under the table and they disappeared into the shadows was now all for peace. As my brain cleared, I began to feel like the redhead and was surprised and disappointed to see that the fight was over. This is the first fight I was ever in where there were a lot of other guys, and I hadn't learned yet that when there are a lot of guys in a fight, it usually doesn't last long. For the simple reason that a lot of guys don't like to fight. Only a few like to fight and know how. Most guys take a couple of punches on the nose and swallow blood and suddenly grow weak with sisterly feelings about brotherly love. All that was left of the war, now that the redhead had retired, was old Mr. Smith standing by the door with a bear hug on the barkeeper. This was probably the first and last time in his life that the barkeeper would walk into the arms of a man who swung a jackhammer for a living. The head of the barkeeper, which was the only part of him that could move, moved wildly. Finally, his arms must have run short of blood, because the revolver dropped from his hand. Bill picked up the .38, flipped open the chamber, shook out the shells, and the war was officially over. My head hurt, and so did my feelings. I was still trying to figure out how the war could have been won without me. Mr. McBride had been out of business most of the time, too, and Mr. Smith had been standing at the door with a bear hug on the barkeeper. As in a lot of big fights, most of the fighting had been done by one fine fighter, and a kid who might grow up to be one. Together they got at least 2 of the hat brims and all of the housemen who racked up the pool balls, and whatever customers were overcome by loyalty to the Oxford. The Canadian was sitting bent over in one of the poker chairs. He was doubled up as if he had to cough, but couldn't. Whatever he'd done was done nobly, but it couldn't have counted for much. The 3 brims sat by themselves, with their brims pulled lower than ever, but they didn't look badly hurt. They were showing each other their fingers. Then they went round the spectators trying to explain that they didn't get into the fight much because they were card players and were afraid to break the bones in their hands. Probably all 3 of the tinhorn gamblers pimped on side for a living. I even suspected one of them was my next-door neighbor last night, but I never got a good enough look to be sure. Mostly, I was trying to get used to the fact that no one seemed really hurt except me, and probably Mr. McBride. Even the place, which looked torn apart when Bill had pulled me from under the table, was being quickly straightened out by the barkeeper and the housemen. Customers helped set up the chairs. The rest of the regular customers started talking, and then one pair started playing pool with a loud bang of the balls. Others followed. Everyone was acting as if nothing had happened, and nothing looked as if it had. I spit out a clot of blood and went over and sat down by the Canadian to find out how he was. He put an arm around me, and I put an arm around him, and that had to be the answer. It seemed suddenly like everybody in the house was Bill's friend, and they all came over to shake his hand or feel how hard his arm was. The cook got up from the floor where he'd been leaning against the wall and tried to be near Bill while Bill was accepting congratulations. And clearly Bill was pleased with everything. The redhead held on to his father, but his eyes still smoldered. Otherwise, all was peace. I couldn't get over it. For at least 2 weeks, we'd been building up steam, and each of us was going to win a summer's wages by some sweep of a black cape, and then we were going to clean out the town. Well, the black cape had swept, and I reached inside my shirt to feel my 10-pound sugar sack, and all the money that was in it could have been put in a Bull Durham sack. We had cleaned out the town, and I already knew that I'd always talk about it. But everything already was running normally again at the Oxford. Even the three tinhorn gamblers had moved back to the poker table and had started an innocent-looking game among themselves, hoping all over that some sheep herder with his summer check would saunter by and they could deal him a sixth card. All the tables were being played on but the billiard table, but it was the time of night that barbers and vice presidents of banks spend with their women before going home to their wives. It's lucky for towns that good fighters first have to be fighters, and that there aren't many of those to start with. Otherwise, towns would be destroyed overnight, because in late summer, every town is going to be cleaned out every night by some crew, and usually is. And then the town straightens up the chairs and goes on taking the crew's money as before. Bill rounded up his bunch and herded us out like sheep. The barkeeper raised his head and said goodbye to us directly. He was selling chits to two married men who were going to get into the pinochle game. Mr. McBride and I were holding each other by the arm, and we felt better when we got outside. But I was hurt, and everyone in the bunch knew it. They also knew I had the money. They helped me around the block, and we stopped at a street corner under an arc light. I sat down on the curbing near the light and rested a few minutes before taking the sack out of my shirt. Everybody gathered close. They gathered so close, Bill finally said, "Get back a bit. We can't get enough light to see." Then he and Mr. Smith went back to counting. I didn't try to help them count. I didn't think I could. First, they gave each of us the money he had bet. Then Bill asked, "Any objection if we split our winnings even 9 ways, no matter what each of the 9 bet? We are one crew, aren't we?" Heads nodded, and he started to sit down again. Then he got up and made what was a speech for him. "And a pretty damn good crew. We always did what we had to. Besides, none of us could do the arithmetic to figure out exactly each one's share." Bill sat down to finish counting our winnings, and we stood around and didn't know what to do but to admire ourselves. I suppose, factually, we were probably not much to brag about. We were fairly representative of early Forest Service crews as I came to know them. Maybe not even that good, because the war had ended less than a year before, and many of the best men had not yet returned to the woods. And the earth was still pretty much in the care of the old, with corrugated skin and tiny steps, and young punks looking for a fight, and gassed Canadians, and anonymous lookouts who had to be there but can't be remembered. Not one had ever seen the inside or the outside of a school of forestry. But as Bill said, we were a pretty good crew, and we did what we had to do, and loved the woods without thinking we owned them. And each of us liked to do at least one thing especially well. Liked to swing a jackhammer and feel the earth overpowered by dynamite. Liked to fight, liked to heal the injuries of horses. Like to handle groceries and tools and tie knots. And nearly all of us like to work. When you think about it, that's a lot to say about a bunch of men. At the moment, in our hearts, we felt indissoluble, although in our heads we knew that after tonight we might never see one another again. We were summer workers. We belonged to no union, no lodge, and most of us had no families and no church. In late spring, we had landed jobs in a new outfit called the United States Forest Service, which we vaguely knew Teddy Roosevelt had helped to get going, and which somehow made us feel proud and tough and always looking for trouble of some sort, like fires, dynamite, and rattlesnakes on mountains too high to have any. Besides doing what we had to, we did a few other things, like playing practical jokes and distilling dried apricots and having some troubles among ourselves. And at the end, We banded together to clean out the town. Probably something also that had to be done for us to become a crew. For most of us, this momentary social unit, the crew, was the only association we had ever belonged to. Although somehow it must have been for more time than a moment. Here I am over half a century later trying to tell you about it. While the ranger and Mr. Smith finished counting, the moths fried on the arc light over us, and the blood again slid inside my head. Bill said to Mr. Smith, "You announce it." Mr. Smith stood up and announced, "The total is $64.80. Split 9 ways, that's $7.20 apiece." Everybody said, "Wow," and forgot all about $7.20 being several hundred dollars short of summer expectations. Bill divided the money, and Mr. Smith said, "Now for the ranch hands and the whores." Some of us wanted to reverse the order. And then, since we were a crew, they suddenly got solicitous about me, but in succession. "How you feeling, kid? You sure took a beating, but you got the dough. Good going, kid." And then Bill said, "We'll walk you back to your hotel." "Hell no," I said. "The night is but a pup." Bill said, "You've had a big night. Now take it easy. But I want you to come to the corral before noon tomorrow and help me saddle up." Then everybody said, again, not together, but one after another, "We'll walk you back to your hotel." So they walked me back. And when we got in front of my 25-cent lodging for the night, we all put our arms around each other, but none of us tried to sing because none of us could carry a tune. Instead, we stood in a circle with heads bowed like a college glee club just before beginning to hum. Then I suddenly felt weak and turned away and started up an uncarpeted stair and was too tired and disappointed in myself to say so long. I rolled over against the plaster wall for comfort. In the center of my brain, the pain from the side of my head met the pain from the front of my head. Never before had I taken 2 beatings in 2 days. I felt especially sensitive to pain, being young and used to winning. Though it was dark in the room, I squeezed my eyes extra tight, hoping to keep out the sight of my lying on the Chinaman's floor with toothpicks in my hair. And I tried to squeeze out the sight of my head leaning over the table, ready to be punched. My head shook in revulsion and tried to back away from what it did not see coming. I thought it was the biggest fight I was ever in, and I swung only 1 punch. Thoughts came slowly, so it was some time before I followed up with the next thought. But if a man had only 1 punch to give for his country, I sure picked a good target. When I quit pulling my head back from my thoughts, I could feel the muscles in my neck relax, and I fell asleep. It was late in the morning when I woke, and I felt just a little better. And while I washed from the pitcher, I was glad there was no mirror. As I awoke, I wanted to take 1 step from the bed and be with Bill at the corral. But when I jumped into my clothes, I looked again at my watch and asked myself, "What's your rush?" Also, I realized that some of the sickness might go from my stomach if I had a little something for breakfast, as my mother would say. It was 10 when I got to the Greek restaurant, and the girl from Darby was on shift. She seated me at a table in a dark corner, started to the front counter to get me a menu, and then came back. "I knew you were in for big trouble last night," she said. "You'd better come and let me wash you off." Then she led me into the ladies' room and locked the door and made me sit down on the cover of the toilet, which, to my surprise, looked the same as the men's toilet. From there, I could lean my head over the basin, and she washed all my head, including my hair. "Don't argue," she said. "You must have rolled in the dirt." "Sawdust," I said. "Oh," she said. I was becoming embarrassed by getting the motherly treatment, and also by the prospect of being seen coming out of a lady's toilet with my hair dripping. But she wouldn't let loose of me. She opened her purse and took out a little tube of something, cold cream probably, and dabbed some of whatever it was on the cut in my forehead. Then she took a comb from her purse and parted my dripping hair using her apron to dry my face. When she leaned over, I could see that her freckles enlarged as they went down her neck, and that her breasts were all brown. "There you are," she said, and let loosen my neck, and I tried not to be seen with her as I came out of the ladies' toilet, but she didn't seem to give a damn. She acted as if it was all business until I finished breakfast. Then she said, looking down at me the way waitresses do while pretending they're looking for dirty dishes, "There's a friend of yours sitting in the alley. I think you'd better go out to see him." "Who?" I asked. "I don't know," she said, "but he's one of your crew." Knowing she didn't have to say any more, she picked up the dishes and I paid the check, and then she led me through the kitchen and opened the door to the alley. He was sitting on a cardboard box full of old newspapers. Although his head was bowed, without doubt it was the cook's, because in a world of men with black hats, he was always bareheaded with a tuft at the top. One of the old newspapers was on the ground between his feet, and he was bent over as if he were reading it, except that blood dropped on it from his unseen face. I walked over slowly toward him to be sure about the blood. "What happened?" I asked. "I'm broke," he said, never raising his head. "But are you hurt?" I asked. "I'm broke," he repeated. "How come?" I asked. "I'm broke. They rolled me," he replied. "Who?" I asked. He looked up at me, and when his head was lifted, the blood ran down his lip into his mouth. Finally, he said, "She was as crooked as a tub of guts." Having scanned that line before, I didn't wait to ask, "Was she just a little whore?" He replied, "I don't feel hurt. I feel broke. I need money to get to Butte." I repeated, "Was it a little whore who rolled you?" He replied, "She had a big guy with her. They beat hell out of me and took my money." I asked, "Did he have a hairy ass?" He replied, "I didn't see his ass." "Well," I told him, "it is hairy." Then I said to myself, "Don't be such a wise guy." And a great shame swept over me for asking him a show-off question that he couldn't possibly answer. By this time, blood had spread into the corners of his mouth. Then I think it was my father who spoke out of the whirlwind of my mind and said unto me, as if he had just written the Bible, "Be ye compassionate." My father reserved the right to speak to me on any occasion and on any subject, even if he knew nothing about it. It was his voice that went on to talk to me about card playing. And in summary, he said I should not rejoice because someone with great gifts in handling cards turned out not to be even a good card player on account of something little, so he said, inside him. Although my father knew absolutely nothing about cards, what he said sounded like him, including his not knowing anything about cards or the cook. "How much do you want?" I asked. "Would you lend me $10? I'll pay it back." As I remembered, it was about 170 miles to Butte, and the coach fare then was 3 cents a mile. I told him, "No, I won't lend you anything, but I'll give you enough to get to Butte. I'll give you $7.20. It's all yours, and I don't want it back." He lowered his head and reached out his hand, and the blood began dripping on the newspaper again. I went into the restaurant, and since it was still a long time before lunch, Miss Brownbreasts was alone. I said to her, "It is the cook." "Yes," she said. I said, "It is the cook." She said, "Yes." I knew I must say something else. I said, "He is hurt. Would you wash him and give him something to eat?" She asked, "Has he any money?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "He didn't have any money before, and the boss threw him out." And I said, "He has money now." And she looked at me and said, "Bring him in." So I went outside and brought the cook in and gave him to the girl from Darby, who took him into the ladies' room and locked the door. Then I started for the road to the corral, where I knew Bill would be saddling up. Bill's dog was there,
and saw me when I was still a long way off. He got up and started toward me. I heard Bill speak to him from the corral, and he quit growling, but he kept coming. He walked around me as if I were a pole, sniffed me once, and then went back and lay in the trail watching the horses. He lay flat on his long belly. His neck, too, was outstretched, and he looped his front paws over his nose. About all you could see of him from the front were his big eyes and bulldog ears. Along the side of one eye was an open cut, and where it was still draining was a fly that he kept trying to blink off. The dog lay there watching over us as if we were sheep. Bill said, "A girl brought him this morning." "Did she have freckles?" I asked. "Lots," he said. "She's nice," I volunteered. "She's a hasher down at the Greek's joint. Here's a note she sent you when she thought maybe she couldn't get the dog here in time. She wanted me to be sure you got it." "Thanks," he said, and stuck the letter in his shirt pocket beside the Bull Durham sack. The dog knew we were talking about him, so he got up and came over and stood by us, ready to be obedient. Bill was only taking 5 horses back with him, counting his own saddled horse, Big Moose, and all but one of them, a pack horse, were saddled. I went into the warehouse and got the blanket and saddle, and I spent an extra amount of time smoothing the blanket on the horse's back. Finally, I said, "She is real nice," and pointed at his shirt pocket. Bill looked over the saddle and down at me. "She's just a kid," he said. "Why don't you take her out?" He evidently thought I was wasting time fussing around with a blanket. He picked up the saddle, which I had dropped at my feet, and he put it on the horse himself. "How many horses are you packing on the way back?" I asked. He said, "They're all going empty but the original." I knew then that he was going to go fast. The original was a big iron gray that was faster and tougher than any of the mules, and meaner. Everybody said that the reason they called him an original was that one of his testicles had been missed when he was castrated, so he wasn't either a gelding or a stallion. You would have thought, though, that he had 2 or 3 complete sets. He started chasing mares the moment you took the saddle off him at night, and it didn't seem to make much difference if you hobbled him. He was the only horse I ever saw that could catch and screw a mare with 2 front feet tied together and only 1 testicle. After he finished with the mares, he started chasing the geldings. If you were the one to wrangle the horses in the morning, you had to start long before daybreak, because by then you'd be lucky to find even one of your string in the state of Idaho. I went slowly to the warehouse to haul out his packs. I went slowly because I wished I were going back with Bill. Here on the valley floor, it was late summer and hot noon. Tonight they would camp on the divide at Big Sand, where it would be deep in autumn. There the needles of the tamaracks had already turned yellow. A delicacy of ice would fringe the lake in the morning. I would be willing to get up and wrangle the horses myself, provided Bill had let me picket the original to a 2-ton log the night before. If so, perhaps I might hear again the most beautiful sound that comes through darkness, the sound of a bell mare. Perhaps, too, at daybreak, I might see my 4-gated moose steaming beside a lily pad. It is certain that for an hour or 2 in life, I would again be higher than the mountain goats and above nearly all men. And it is certain that if I weren't dehydrated, I would piss on the state line and wonder where in the world I had flowed. I set a pack on each side of the original. I don't care what anybody says, it is a great advantage to be a big man if you were a packer. I admit I have seen some fine packers who were middle-sized, and some even who were small, but a big man picks up a pack and just pushes it away from him, and it's about where he wants it on the saddle, and he can work with everything in plain view in front of him. At 17, I was probably about 5'9", and had to hoist the pack up on my shoulders and work from underneath, sometimes not seeing the hitches I was tying, and also sometimes not finishing my sentences. "The cook," I said, and the pack slipped as I tried to hoist it up on the saddle. And besides, I didn't know how to go on. "He didn't look good this morning," I said, even though I hadn't got a good hold on the pack yet. "What was the matter?" Bill asked.
Bill didn't look too good himself. When he leaned his head back to push the pack up, I could see dried blood in his nose, and his hands were swollen, and we packed slowly. "They rolled him and beat hell out of him," I said. "Did they get all his dough?" Bill asked. "I had to give him money to get to Butte," I told him. The dog figured we weren't talking about him anymore, so he went back to watching the horses. $7.20, I said. You could almost hear Bill from the other side of the horse multiplying 170 miles by 3 cents. "That's enough," he said. I wanted bad to say one more thing about the cook, but the dog was uncomfortable and got up and circled stiffly and then lay down again. He looked a lot older than when I had seen him last spring. Besides the open cut near his eyes, he had several fresh scars that were also close to his eyes. I thought to myself, what can you expect if you fight coyotes for a living? So I didn't say this other thing about the cook for fear I might end up in the same trouble as the dog. Although Bill was putting a light load on the original, we started to tie it tight together with a diamond hitch because clearly he was going to travel fast. Bill threw the canvas mantle over the load and each of us smoothed out his side of it. Bill asked, tossing the cinch to me under the horse, "What are you going to do next summer?" Until I heard my answer tremble, I did not know how long I had been waiting for the question. "Nothing yet," I answered. "Let's tie a double diamond on this last load," he suggested. "Fine," I said. "How would you like to work for me next summer?" he asked. I went looking for words like privilege and honor and ended with, "It's a deal." "It's a deal," he replied. "I'll write you early in the spring." "When I get here next spring," I said, hidden by my side of the horse, "I'll date that girl with all the freckles." "She's nice," he said. "Real nice." "I know," I said. Suddenly I realized I had been scared for a long time, because suddenly I wasn't scared anymore. I'd been scared ever since I'd started getting in trouble with Bill, but didn't dare admit it to myself. I don't believe I was ever afraid he would take a punch at me, because I don't believe I ever thought he would. I was scared because I had to lose something I wanted to be like, and yet wanted to keep when the trouble was over. On our last load of the summer, we threw the double diamond, and Bill was ready to go. He didn't tie his string together. He had picked his best horses, and they would trail each other. We stood beside Big Moose, his giant saddle horse. We stood close together and never said a word. Then he turned slightly, twisted his stirrup, and with his back to me started a 180-degree swing into the saddle. When he completed his semicircle, he was looking down at me from the sky. From my angle below, I could see right up the barrel of his .45 and up his nostrils, rimmed with dry blood. "I'll be seeing you," he said. "Me too," I answered, but didn't quite know what I meant. I let down the bars of the corral, and the moment the outfit was on the road, each assumed his own character, and collectively all became Bill's string. Big Moose immediately hit his 5-mile-an-hour stride. Dark brown and moose-like, with head thrown back, he coasted on slipper-like feet. You wouldn't realize he was covering 5 miles an hour until you noticed that the other horses, except the original, would drop behind when they walked, and every now and then had to trot to catch up. The original kicked a horse that got too close. The dog trotted to one side, stopping now and then with raised paw, and in his mind clearly protecting the string from all possible attack and any combination of coyotes. Bill sat twisted in his saddle like the Egyptian bas-relief. Collectively, Bill's outfit, Bill himself, his favorite saddle horse, his favorite pack horse, and his dog, were about the finest the early Forest Service had to offer. For a while, the road went mostly down the valley and only slightly toward the mountains. And then it took a sudden turn to the left and headed nearly straight for Blodgett Canyon. Bill studied his horses almost to the turn. Then he must have stood up in his stirrups, for suddenly he took off his hat and gave me a big wave. And I stood on the middle rail of the corral and gave him a big wave back.
He must have been feeling great. Why not? Maybe for the first time in years, the Ranger had got out of a card game while he was still ahead, by $7.20. Although I still was not well, I felt great too. I had the promise that I could work for him again. I was only 17, and I hoped more than ever that someday I would become a Packer. Then the string swung to the left and trotted in a line toward Blodgett Canyon, with a speck of a dog to the side, faithfully keeping always the same distance from the horses. Gradually, the trotting dog and horses became generalized into creeping animals, and the one to the side became a speck, and those in a line became just a line. Slowly, the line disintegrated into pieces, and everything floated up and away in dust, and all that settled out was one dot, like Morse code. The dot must have been Morse code for a broad back and a black hat. After a while, the sunlight itself became disembodied. There was just nothing at all to sunlight, and the mouth of Blodgett Canyon was just nothing but a gigantic hole in the sky. The big sky, as we say in Montana. Although I had no way of knowing it at the time, I was never to cross the Bitterroot Mountains again. When early spring came, I was offered a job for the summer with the engineering department of the Forest Service on a mapping crew that was going to work in the Kootenai Forest. For a long time I wondered why, by the spring of 1920, it seemed to me that having a different and more professional job in a different part of the woods was better than working again for Bill Bell. And I think the answer has something to do about my becoming 18. I was very conscious of becoming 18. So I was never to see Bill Bell or any of the other men again, or the girl my age from Darby. When the dot of Morse code disappeared into the sky, another summer crew of the United States Forest Service had come and gone forever. Everything that was to happen had happened, and everything that was to be seen had gone. It was now one of those moments when nothing remains but an opening in the sky and a story, and maybe something of a poem. Anyway, as you possibly remember, there are these lines in front of the story. And then he thinks he knows the hills where his life rose. These words are now part of the story. A River Runs Through It and Other Stories was produced and directed by Paul Rubin. This has been a Highbridge Audio presentation.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.